This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson, host of Writer's Voices. With me today, I have a very interesting guest. Our guest today is Eric Johnson, founder of Inkslinger Industries. He will discuss writing, formatting, and marketing ebooks, and also other topics related to new trends in publishing. Eric's latest book, How to Make a Book with iBooks Author, was created in an ebook format. Eric explored book arts at Brown University, where he handcrafted books using fine arts techniques taught by Walter Feldman, whose artists' books are included in over 150 public collections. Eric also studied the interdisciplinary artistic practice of cave writing under author Robert Coover's direction. Cave writing takes place in a CAVE simulator, a virtual reality environment typically reserved for scientific visualization. And while at Brown, Eric also served as a writing fellow. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I feel like we have lots of interesting topics we can cover today. We may do public disclosure that Eric is actually also my son.
Conspicuously related, yes.
So it's the fact that we both have the last name Johnson is not a coincidence. So I'd like to start with exploring a little bit about book arts and then work our way up to e-publishing. So talk a little bit about what you did at Brown in the area of book arts.
Okay, well, Walter Feldman took us on a year-long crash course of sort of a range of different things that you could do with artists' books. So first, an artist book is basically a limited edition of a book. Like you make maybe 5 or 10 or 25 copies in one edition of one book and you build them by hand. And we started out making the simplest form of artist books, which are chap books. And that's just basically, you know, you're taking pieces of paper and folding them down the middle and then sewing a piece of thread through them to connect them. And you could do anything on it. You could write by hand. You could do stencil work. You could make stamps. You could do watercolors. And we started out doing that kind of stuff. And then we moved into more advanced techniques. We did woodblock printing. We used linotype and monotype printers, so like big, you know, printers the size of like a big table that weigh a couple thousand pounds, like Vandercook presses, these kinds of things, and sort of worked our way up to more book-like things, you know, like proper hardback books where we built the binding and, you know, we did perfect binding, which is like glue, and we did sewn binding, and we did all these different kinds of binding, and we used stuff that we printed with a computer printer. We used stuff we printed, you know, by hand with these mechanical printers, and we used woodblock prints and watercolors and stencils, and sort of worked through maybe half a dozen to a dozen different projects in sort of an escalating degree of complexity.
So what drew you to study book arts?
Gosh, that's a good question. I took a few art classes in college, and most of them were kind of not that fantastic because, you know, I mean, it's not really an art school properly, but Walter Feldman, he kind of stood out in the pack, like just looking in the course catalog as, first of all, he's teaching something that's really unusual. There's not that many book arts programs anywhere. Secondly, he's, you know, a luminary in his field over and above most of the art professors there at that time. And it just seemed like a fantastic opportunity. And I was a senior, so sort of like last chance. And that's, you know, I just kind of ended up there and somehow managed to squeak my way in.
And that was his last year of teaching at Brown, was it?
That was his last year of teaching, yeah. He's still alive. He was quite elderly then. I think he was in his early or mid-80s at the time. This is like 5 years ago. And he was a professor emeritus after that. And actually, one of my classmates worked with him as some kind of an assistant. But at that time, like, that was his last year, and they brought in a new professor to teach that course after him.
So that was a really great opportunity for you.
Definitely.
So talk about some of the books you created.
Well, the earlier projects I don't remember quite as well, the chat books and accordion books and things like that. But some of the more memorable books, we made the first hardcover book that we made. I remember I picked out like a early scientific paper because I was also studying biology at the time. So I wanted something that like expressed, you know, sort of both of my interests. And I don't know where I found it, but I found this very early paper that studied, that was maybe one of the first papers to kind of establish the idea of ecosystem ecology, like how a food web works and the interrelationship of different animals. And it's like an early paper from the 1880s. And I laid it out in Adobe InDesign and printed it out on a laser printer. So did sort of the high-tech thing for that side of it. and then cased it in and built the cover and, you know, the hardback aspect of it and printed the labels on it all in sort of the more traditional ways that we've been doing by hand, basically. And so that one was kind of memorable.
Let's talk a little bit more about that one.
Sure.
So that was called The Lake as a Microcosm, was the name of the paper.
That was the name of the paper.
And it was written by Stephen A. Forbes, and he wrote that, I think that was actually a lecture he delivered in 1887. And I found a note about this online, and it was interesting that when I typed in the name of that essay, I got like 6 million responses. So this is a paper that it seems like is really instrumental in the environmental movement. But I found this editor's note that the person who wrote this, Stephen Forbes, was state entomologist of Illinois and professor of zoology and entomology at Illinois State University when he delivered that lecture. And he later became the first director of the Illinois Natural History Survey. And this essay is a genuine classic in the history of the development of the field of ecology, anticipating later studies on food webs, population and community ecology, and the ecosystem concept. So I thought it was sort of interesting that you picked this seminal essay to use for your exploration of the physicality of the book.
Right. Yeah. I remember for that project, we had a lot of leeway in terms of what content to put in the book, because for that particular project anyway, the idea was to make a hardcover book. So some people did purely illustrative things. Other people composed, you know, their own poems. And a number of us picked essays or poems that other people had written and then, you know, redesigned them and made them into a new sort of physical form. So there was a lot of variation in terms of what you could do, and that was sort of what I chose to do.
I found this to be a really interesting essay to read. I haven't taken a lot of science classes in my life, and there were so many words that sort of rolled off the tongue that I made notes of some of these words, like entomostraca, fluviatile, non-predaceous, animalcules, collocation, copidopa, cladocera, ostracoda. It's just like there were so many odd words in this essay, and yet the author put them together. And even though it was a scientific paper, when I read this book that you had created with this with this scientist's words, it felt like it was poetry. I thought it was really an astounding piece of literature.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's a sort of, you might call it the scientific sublime. You know, it's like a form of sort of austere beauty that comes from that kind of classification and, you know, deep study of a subject.
Do you feel that that still exists in scientific circles where people write in this way, or was that a product
definitely,
of the 18th?
Definitely. I mean, I think that then or now, it's pretty hard for a non-specialist to understand a scientific paper because there's so much technical language. But, you know, if you kind of know what they're talking about a little bit, I think that you definitely see this sort of beautiful flow, this like poetic flow. I mean, that said, there are good writers and bad writers in science, just like there are anywhere.
Well, that brings up an interesting topic. So what do you think makes a good writer? And can a bad writer be made into a good writer?
Do you mean in scientific disciplines or in general?
In general.
Well, you mentioned earlier that I was a writing fellow, which what that was like a peer tutoring program where we basically were not supposed to focus on sort of atomistic things like grammar and spelling, but instead we were supposed to help fellow classmates with the kind of the overall thrust of their essays in college. So maybe I'm biased, but just because of that experience, I guess I would say that, you know, having like a consistent flow of what you're saying, you know, being on point, you know, whether you're bringing in evidence to support a point or you're expressing an opinion or you're introducing a topic or you're concluding, you know, having like a consistent thrust and, you know, a holistic view of your topic is very important.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know that I would get that answer from a lot of people.
Well, I think it's just sort of expresses my biases as, you know, that's the only context in which I've had to teach other people
how
to write.
So it was like academic papers.
Academic, but also, I mean, we weren't copy editors. We weren't really allowed to talk about grammar and spelling, even when like a student's grammar and spelling were abominable. That's not what we were supposed to talk about. We were supposed to help them with the kind of higher level aspects of their writing. So that's just what I know, I guess.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. No, everything, that's really interesting. So We may come back to the lake as a microcosm later and give you an opportunity to read a little bit about it. But I'd like to talk more about the process of the physicality of the book and making the book. So you had to, did you make the paper for this book as well?
Well, I think you have a copy of that book right around here somewhere. And if I could take
a
look at it.
In fact, I do have that right here. And I have to say, whenever I handle this book, I feel like I should have white gloves on, you know, like it's a real precious piece of...
Well, it's funny you mention that, because actually they had us sort of donate a lot of our books, a lot of the better books, not kind of the earlier ones, but the better ones once we'd been in this course for, you know, most of a semester, or most of a year, rather. They had us donate them to the artist's books collection of the John Hay Library, which is one of the libraries at Brown. And so presumably, if future generations ever check out this book, they'll have to handle it with white gloves, because that's what you have to do there for every book. But anyway, yeah, back to making it. One thing that's kind of interesting about everything that we did is we used to always write colophons for all of our books, which you basically don't see in books anymore.
And what is a colophon?
A colophon, the closest thing to a colophon nowadays is the copyright page. And the copyright page, if you look at a copyright page nowadays, it'll have all this copyright language. It's really boring. And maybe in small print, it'll say, like, we used Helvetica for a font. But the colophons of the old days were mostly about how the book was made and maybe had, like, a small one-line mention of the copyright. So the colophon for this, I haven't looked at this in years. Let's see what it says. It says, "The Lake as a Microcosm is considered one of the foundational papers in the field of ecology. Forbes developed ideas that led directly to later work on food webs, population ecology, and the ecosystem concept. This reprint of the classic paper was designed by Eric Johnson in February 2007. The text is Times, printed on an Epson Stylus Photo 1280 printer. The images are linoleum cut prints, also by Eric Johnson." So that's sort of what colophons would have been, you know, 100 years ago. They kind of go into more depth about the tools that were used, the fonts that were used, maybe a little bit about the purpose behind the book, why the book was made in the first place. And then, you know, often at the bottom of the page, you'd see like a copyright notice. And so now we're kind of, you know, I guess the thinking by publishers is that people don't care so much about how a book is made. Or also, probably honestly, part of it is that books as objects just aren't very nice nowadays. They're kind of not, especially like trade paperbacks, mass market paperbacks are not that exciting to look at.
Or to feel.
There's something to feel. Yeah, the paper's
not good. A book with
the
handmade paper has this creamy touch. There's this tactile quality to a handmade book that is really special.
Right, exactly. And actually this, I'm surprised that I didn't say what the paper was. A lot of the books we made, we specified the manufacturer of the paper.
Did you sometimes make paper in the class?
We did make paper. Paper that you make by hand is surprisingly difficult to print words on, I found. It's pretty rough. It's got a lot of texture. So we made paper, and we mostly used it for printing like wood block or linoleum block prints. But yeah, making paper is a really physical process. It's a lot of fun. You take basically a lot of fabric, so mostly, you know, cotton-based fabrics. Like a popular material we used was denim pants. Also just t-shirts, like vintage t-shirts, different colors.
Where did
you
get this stuff?
Cut them up. We just like buy them at Goodwill. We'd go en masse and just buy like huge trash bags full of old clothes at Goodwill and Salvation Army. And then you cut them up into maybe 1-inch squares. And then you put the squares into what is essentially a gigantic blender, but it's called a Hollander beater. And so it's made by Hollander, and the device is a beater, I guess. And like Hollander is like the big name in like paper making machinery, I guess.
Is there a lot of that around?
Well, we were using one of their smallest machines that you might have in, you know, a studio. But they make the really big stuff too that people use, you know, like the major paper manufacturers
used to
make like real paper, you know. And so it just like pulverizes these fabrics for hours until there's nothing but like inch-long fibers left, and there's no identifiable fragments of cloth. That's just fibers. And then basically what you do is, you know, that you have this mash. I can't remember what exactly we called it, but, you know, almost it's like the same kind of language as beer making or something. Like it's mashes and musts and all these things. And you take these frames that are made out of wood, and then they have a wire mesh running through them. And you can actually use the same screen door material you use for a door or a window. But, you know, if you're more of like a high-end paper maker, like if you're doing this because you're a craftsman and you're an artist, you probably are making your own weaves out of metal that are more specifically kind of, you know, designed for you. But, you know, if you're doing this at home, you could literally use a kitchen blender and then use screen from your window, basically. And you use that, you dip that into like your big tub of this like water and cloth mixture, and you just kind of work it until you get an even layer. And that takes a lot of skill. Like, that's the hard part, is to get like the mash coming out evenly on your screen. And so you can
otherwise
tell,
you get lumpy paper.
Yeah, otherwise you get lumpy paper, and it's actually kind of hard to tell until you've pressed it and dried it whether it's lumpy or not. So it's like it takes a lot of trial and error until you can tell what movement you're doing that's getting the right type of thickness.
Oh, so interesting.
Yeah,
so
you don't want it too thick, you don't want it too thin, and you definitely don't want it lumpy. So you, once you get it to the right level of thickness, you put them in these drying racks and dry them overnight. And then you take it out, and then you press it between layers of kind of a different kind of, like, a basically a blotter paper that, like, you know, you would have used 100 years ago with, like, a fountain pen or, like, an inkwell pen, I guess. So you take, like, a layer of blotter paper, then a layer of your homemade paper, then another layer of blotter paper. And you take that whole thing and you put cardboard around it. And then you just keep making these layers, and then you put them in a press. And we had the benefit of, like, a 2-ton press or something that I think was taken from, like, a nice, like, a high-end car jack, and then rebuilt by hand into this, like, pretty heavy-duty press that could have lifted a car. And that's how we pressed out, like, the last remnants of the water. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely, like, a really interesting, really physical process. That's not what I did for this particular book, because that kind of paper won't run through a laser printer. But for this book, you know, the process to make this book, you don't need all that equipment. This is something that you might be a little bit easier to do at home. I mean, I basically, let's see, I'm just looking at it, trying to see what I did.
And while you're looking, I want to remind listeners, this is Writer's Voices on KRUU FM 100.1. I am Cheryl Fusco Johnson. My guest today is Eric Johnson, and we're talking about handmade art books, and we're also going to spend part of the hour talking about how to make an e-book. So did you have any more comments about that book?
Yeah, I just had a quick comment about, well, about the process. I mean, this book is probably more similar to a book that you would buy than most handmade artist books, because it looks as though I did a perfect binding, which is really far from perfect. That's just an industry term. And that what that means is that the pages are all separate, and they're connected with glue at the spine.
Instead,
and that's in contrast to a signature-bound book where you take maybe 8 pages that are folded and sew them together, and then take another 8 pages and sew them together and keep doing that, and then you connect all those signatures, is what they're called, to the binding. So signature binding is sort of more beautiful and much more labor-intensive, but it also, you know, the pages won't fall out. So this was, I think, one of the exercises here was that we were doing perfect binding. And then, you know, it's hardback. You can actually just buy the material to make these hardcover books in an art store. The cover material is a little trickier. You know, it's like it's that kind of coarse hardcover fabric. And you buy that in rolls. And, you know, that's like a little bit harder to source. And then you do need kind of a hot press to attach it with glue to the binding, if you want it to really stick. I mean, you could do it by hand, but it wouldn't be quite as solid.
So right now we're talking about a handmade book that was called, let me remind, The Lake as a Microcosm, which is a very famous classic essay by Stephen Forbes, which Eric made into this book. You've been talking about where people can get the materials to do this. Do you feel that as electronic books become more popular, there's also a concomitant rise in the popularity of handmade books?
Absolutely, I do. I think that what we're seeing is kind of a bifurcation in the publishing industry. I think that we'll take mass market paperbacks. Those are the kind of really low quality paperbacks you'd take to the beach. You know what I mean? Like the ones where the ink smears and the pages turn yellow, like within a year, you know, those ones. And those, already, I think the U.S. is one of the few places they still exist. Like, they haven't existed in England or Europe in, like, 20 or 30 years.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, the people over there kind of got fed up with them, is my understanding. And they're just too low quality, and the margins are too low, the profit margins. So I think that those kind of books are going to be the first casualties of digital publishing, and the Kindle is basically replacing those first.
So the content will still be available, but it'll be available in e-formats.
Right, and if you think about it, those kind of mass market books are the cheapest way to buy a book, and they're the most disposable. So they're going to be the first casualties of digital, which is sort of cheap and not really disposable because you have your copy forever. You're not going to throw it away, but it's not something that's treasured. It's like you read it and you're done, right? You know, so it's like perfect for just those kind of beach reading, like summer novels, you know, or for the latest kind of, you know, nonfiction book of the month or whatever. You know what I mean? The stuff that's kind of the latest business book that everybody's reading in airports, but nobody cares about in a year. Like, that stuff is perfect for the Kindle, and there's really no reason for it to be printed.
Well, what is not perfect for the Kindle?
Well, anything that... Well, okay, so that's like a two- or a multi-part question, I think. But the thing is, you know, digital publishing has its weaknesses, right? So the Kindle specifically is great for text, but it's kind of horrible for images. The iPad is better for images, but it's still, you know, it's still got, I don't know, trade-offs vis-a-vis a printed book. So I think that what you're going to see survive in print, in, you know, like a physical thing you can hold, are books that make the most of that platform, that use the materials in a way that, I mean, they're basically, it's like the content just can't be in any other format or it won't be as good.
And what are some examples of that?
Well, I think, like, you know, kind of to take it to its farthest extreme, the example is like paper engineering, which is basically pop-up books.
Have you done some of those yourself?
I have. I'll come back to that in a moment. But so I think that's one extreme. I think artist books in general are an extreme where, you know, it's literally the book is an artifact. I mean, basically what I'm saying is I think that books that are artifacts, that are intentionally artifacts, will continue to be popular or become even more popular as physical books. And books where it's all about the content, where the medium doesn't matter, and it's, you know, and what matters is the content, those are the ones that are going to go digital. So if you say, like, a novel, nobody really cares that much if it's hardcover or paperback. And the only reason that people sell both is because it's a way that they can price discriminate. They sell you the hardcover now. If you're willing to pay $25, you can get the book now, or you can wait 6 months and buy the paperback for half the price. And instead of just making it blatant and being like, okay, buy today for $25, buy in 6 months for $15, they make a different version. You know, they make it hardcover versus paperback, but it's just a way to price discriminate between buyers who want a book immediately versus those who are willing to wait. So already we can tell people just don't care. You know, if it's like a novel, you don't really care if it's paperback or hardcover. You just want to read it. And so those kind of books are going to go to the Kindle and the iPad and so forth. The books where the artifact is what matters and it almost doesn't matter what's in it, you know what I mean? Like, think about a kid playing with a pop-up book. You know, it's like, it doesn't really matter if it's like Wizard of Oz or if it's about the skyline of New York. Like, kids love pop-up books. And there's no way that the Kindle can replace that experience. So those books that are about it being an artifact are the books that are going to continue to be popular in print. And actually, apparently, pop-up books are doing a really good, strong business these days.
Oh,
like, they continue to do really well because they're so popular. And, you know, I think people do like something that they can hold on to, especially if there's a reason for them to hold on to it.
So talk a little bit about your experience. Was that at Brown that you made pop-up books?
Yeah, we made a pop-up book. We all had to make a pop-up book for one of our projects in that same class with Walter Feldman. And so, first of all, in the industry, they call it paper engineering because it sounds way more awesome, I guess. You know, but which I guess technically paper engineering encompasses more than a pop-up. I can't remember exactly. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, we have to puff ourselves up and like seem really overimportant, I think. But pop-up is technically just where you open the pages and something comes up at you. But most paper engineered books have more than pop-ups going on. They have stuff you can move, like levers you can pull and tabs and like things happen and little spinny wheels and stuff. I mean, I've seen some fantastic pop-up books like the Wizard of Oz one. I have a Wizard of Oz one that, you know, you can spin the cyclone and stuff like that. Like, you can just turn it. It's like a wheel. So, yeah, that stuff, we didn't do anything quite that ambitious because it's amazing how difficult it gets if you do that kind of stuff.
Does it take a team of people to create a pop-up or can an individual?
Well, not in our class. We each made our own. We each made our own. And it was a fair bit of work. I mean, it took like a lot of trial and error for all of us, I think, to figure out just how to make things like move the way you want them to in your head. In your head, you see it one way, and when it happens, it's just not happening the right way. So it took a lot of effort. It was definitely a challenge. The professionals do have more of a team. I mean, there's this duo. I wish I could remember their name right now, but they're,
I think I know who you're talking about. They came and spoke in Cedar Rapids.
Cedar Rapids or Iowa City. I saw them a number of years ago. I think they're a gay couple from New York, and they're partners, and one of them is the paper engineer.
Is it Sloboda? Sloboda is one of them?
Maybe. I just honestly don't remember. We might have to look that up during a break or something. but one of them, the way that they divide their work is that one of them is the illustrator, I believe. One of them is the illustrator, and one does more of the paper engineering. But I think they can both do both, because they've been doing it for so long. And honestly, most of the really famous pop-up books are made by them.
Huh.
Like, most of them, if you go to a bookstore, they won't necessarily have their names on them. But if you go to a bookstore and see, this Wizard of Oz book, or just anything that's just over the top in terms of its complexity and artistry, and just head and shoulders above other pop-up books, it's them. Basically, they're the powerhouse.
So they created their niche.
And I remember what they explained is that when you're doing it at their level, where it's not like an artist book that you're making, five copies of, but it's something that you're mass producing, how it works is the illustrator draws an image first, and then the pop-up artist cuts it all out and figures out how to make it move and stuff. And then they recut it out and they put everything onto a big sheet. I forget how big, but 16 by 30 inches or something like that, and try to cram everything into one sheet and then send it to the printers in Singapore. And I think all pop-up books are made in Singapore these days. I think most high-end books are made in Singapore. That's the place to get a book printed if it's beautiful and high-end. And then that way, there's as little waste as possible, because they've crammed all the pieces into as few sheets as possible. And then the Singaporean printers, figure out kind of how to cut everything out and make it into a book. And that's that. And that's the process.
Wow.
So it's sort of interesting. When we did it, we started with the cutting, because otherwise it was just impossible to think about what you're doing. But
so you
I guess
worry
at the higher level, they do
paper.
Illustration first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you also studied, so we've been talking about the physicality of the book. But while you were at Brown, you also studied with Robert Coover. And tell us a little bit about this. Oh, wait. I also want to remind listeners, we're on KRUU-FM 100.1, community radio, solar-powered radio, and the show is Writers' Voices. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson. With me today is my guest, Eric Johnson, who has recently created a book called How to Make a Book with iBooks Author. So we also need to spend some time talking about your book. But I think most listeners probably are unfamiliar with cave writing. Could you tell us what that is?
Sure. Well, just a little background. Coover is more famous for his short stories than his cave writing. Cave writing. So I took a course with him where cave writing was just one of several things we did. So, cave writing, I don't have a ton of experience with it. But basically, the cave was a virtual reality simulator that was, I think, in either the applied math department or, the geology or the engineering department or something. And what it was is it was a room with, I guess, five sides. It's like a cube with one open side that you walk through. And then they had a projector coming from underneath onto the floor. Projectors coming from, all the three walls, one to each side and one in front of you, but from the other side of the wall, right? So, the transparent walls, or they're semi-transparent walls, and then another one from the roof. And then you wear these VR goggles that are basically 3D goggles like you get in a movie theater, except they're electrically powered, they're not passive. And so how that works is that it flickers, one of your eyes is off and one is on, and it flickers them. And there's these motion sensors or proximity sensors that can detect where you are in the room. And depending on where you are, it changes how the image looks, so that, it really feels like you're inside of a 3D environment. Like you can reach out and touch these images.
So bizarre. It's the complete total opposite of making writing in this fine art package.
Right.
This is a space age form of, does it actually even use, what's the writing part of cave writing?
Well, what the room is for is scientific visualizations, it's the same kind of technology that oil companies use to explore undersurface oil deposits, basically. It's for that kind of stuff. You know, and it's just
like
available.
Finding the Titanic or something.
Yeah, yeah, and it's available for different departments to visualize their data in 3D spaces. And Robert Coover somehow must have convinced them to let him use it for sort of storytelling purposes. And so it's very like experimental. I mean, I don't know what kind of applicability it would have outside of that environment, because everything that we did in it, and we only did a subset of what I think he does, because he would teach graduate level courses just in that. But in the class that I took, that was just like a 1 week segment or 2 week segment or something. And, you know, the work that we did, there's no way that you could even view it outside of there. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it would be outside of there. Like, the kind of thing we did is, you know, we created these kind of like clouds or bubbles that would have like different sentence fragments and phrases in them. And it's sort of like you would just reach out and grab them and, you know, combine them, and you touch one and then you'd get a new set of selections of other things that would come up. And so it was like a really like exploratory thing. Like, you know, it was almost like a choose your own adventure, but it was more a stream of consciousness, you know, poetry, right?
Were multiple people doing this? So you're all in a room?
No, you can only fit one person in a room at a time.
Oh. Yeah. So you like reserve space, like the time that you're going to
go. Well, the whole
in.
Class would go. And the rest of us, you could sit around and watch the person who's in it. And you could sort of see what's on the screen, but it would all be separated. It would be like double vision, because if you're not wearing the 3D glasses, it all looks like double vision. Or you could sit and watch a computer screen, which wouldn't really be the same as watching what he's watching, or, you know, he being whoever's in the environment. But you could see, you could sort of like be like behind the scenes watching it being controlled. You know what I mean? Like, you could watch like the different phrases that are possible. And I don't know. I mean, it's really an experience that you can only experience one at a time in the room, I guess is what I'm saying.
What did you think when you were doing that? I mean, did you think this is the future of literature?
No,
you think
of course not. I mean, it's fascinating. It's an interesting experiment. But it's both, I would say it's simultaneously high art in the sense of being experimental and impractical. And it's just, you know, like boundary pushing in the sense of, you know, let's expand the notion of how we can tell a story with text. Right.
Well, did the end product, let's say when you were going in and you have these clouds with words and you're grabbing them, did you feel like you were creating a story?
Well, oh, no. See, that was the experience. What we did as a class is like write some of the stuff that we put in there. What we didn't do is create the code. Like, you know, if I was in his graduate class, what I would have been expected to do is actually either do it myself or work with a programmer to invent like a new thing that's not like the bubble thing, but to invent like a new use for it.
A new use for the room.
Right.
With storytelling.
But since we only just went in as like a week or two as part of a class where we were exploring a lot of ideas in sort of new ways of storytelling, we mostly just used what other people had already made. Right. So we experienced it. We wrote some new fragments for these bubbles, but we didn't create the bubble thing from scratch. You know, like you'd need to do a lot of computer, you know, programming to do that.
Interesting.
But we did other stuff with him. You know, we used wikis. We used Max MSP, which is software that's made for Macs. I think they might have it for Windows now too. And it's usually used to control like video and audio software. So like, let's say you're a musician or you're a multimedia artist and you want to control like four TVs that are going to have different like patterns of green and blue light or something, and you also want to play your music, and then you want to have like a live feed, you know, and then keyboards, and you need to link it all up somehow, and you link it all up through your computer with the software called Max MSP. But we used it to do like storytelling, like to connect like fragments of video and text and things like that, which is like a really unusual use for it.
So it was a multimedia type of storytelling.
Yeah. And then we also used wikis, you know, and this was, you know, a few years ago. So we were kind of playing with telling stories through a wiki, you know, just like Wikipedia, but much more, you know, which is basically telling a story through a wiki is like sort of an easy way to tell story through HTML, just basically just like a hypertext story. And if you think about like what hypertext is, it just means text where you can jump from one place to another. So really, like, hypertext is just the same as like a choose your own adventure, right? So a choose your own adventure anticipated hypertext, but because it's stuck in paper, it's way more primitive. So, yeah,
well,
so we did stuff like that.
Really,
we played around with it. I would say Coover's class Coover's class and Feldman's class were the exact opposite. Like, Walter Feldman was very invested in the book as an artifact, the book as a piece of art. And Robert Coover was very invested in the absolute cutting edge of storytelling that has nothing to do with a book whatsoever. You know, so, and maybe in between there somewhere is like a normal book, but I don't know.
Well, I think we could talk about those dichotomies for hours, but let's move on to the book that you've just completed.
Right. Okay. So I recently started a blog where I also create guides and tutorials, and it's called InkslingerIndustries.com. And Inkslinger is sort of used to be, it's a little bit maybe outdated as a phrase now, but it's like an old-fashioned slang word for a writer, sort of like a hack, you know what I mean? Like, you know, a hack is sort of journalistic phrase maybe, and an inkslinger is sort of like you're just pumping out romance novels or something, you know? So I thought it was kind of funny to reclaim that. And mostly what I've been working on is both blogging and then creating a guide about iBooks Author. And that's software that Apple made a few months ago. And so, you know, of course there's a Kindle. Everyone knows about the Kindle, but Apple also has a book platform. And it only works on the iPad. And it's called iBooks. And they have their bookstores called the iBookstore. And it used to be that you would submit your book in the EPUB format. That's E-P-U-B. And the EPUB format is like an industry standard. And Apple still supports it. But I guess they decided that it didn't do enough cool stuff that they wanted to do, so they made their own format. And now you can submit your book in either iBooks or EPUB. And since, you know, nobody else uses their own format, they had to make their own software to make a book for it. And so they made this software, and it's free software, but it only works on a Mac, and you need the latest version of the Mac OS, 10.7. And it's called iBooks Author, and it's basically, like, you know, just sort of simple design software that's very focused on just making books. So it's kind of like Adobe InDesign, except you can't make a poster, or you can't make, you know, a printed book, or you can't make a business card. You can just make iBooks. So it's very focused. And I thought that since it's brand new, nobody really knows how to use it yet, and it might be interesting to be one of the first people to make a guide about it. And so I've been blogging about it, and then I also recently created an ebook guide, so it's available in several formats on that website and on my inkslingerindustries.com.
So the name
website
of your book is How to Make a Book with iBooks Author.
Yes, and very literal.
People were interested in obtaining a copy, they should go to Inkslinger's Industry.
That's correct, and it also includes a template. So the software iBooks Author comes with 6 templates, but they kind of pitched their software and their platform as a platform mostly for textbooks, which is fine. I mean, Apple's always had that kind of connection to education and academia. You know, they've always been hot on being in elementary schools and stuff. But, you know, those templates are really terrible if you're doing anything other than a textbook. Like, if you want to make a children's book or a novel, those templates, you're going to spend a lot of time just dismantling them before you can start doing your own design and making it look the way you want it to look. So I include a template with my book that gives you a jump start because it's already kind of taken out all of the cruft, and it's just very stripped down and very minimal, and it would be perfect to use right now if your book is all text, like if you're writing a novel, and it would be a good base to build from for something with more images. You won't have to take anything out. You'll just add to it, in other words.
So some points that are probably interesting to listeners are this software, the iBooks Author, is free software.
It's free software.
But what you're saying is it's a little bit clunky. It's geared for academic writing.
No, I'm just saying the templates that they include with it are clunky. iBooks Author is very easy to use. If anyone out there has used the iWork suite, which is, you know, Pages, Numbers, it's all of Apple's software that's a competitor to Microsoft Office, you know, but it's very easy to use and kind of stripped down. This is like that. It's a familiar interface. It's pretty simple. I mean, there's like a number of gotchas and little things, like quirks. Like any software has a number of quirks, right, that a guide will help you avoid those quirks. But no, I just meant specifically the templates are very sort of, they just look like old-fashioned, you know, they just look like kind of old textbooks, you know? And so if you want to make something that's more of an edgy design, or if you want to make something that you know, it's just text. Like, really, it's just a, you know, plain text novel. You don't have a lot of, like, fancy photos and stuff. You're going to have to spend a lot of designing time taking out stuff instead of building stuff.
So with your template, what you've created is something where people don't have to take that stuff out.
Right.
You've already done that.
Right. It's already, I've stripped out all of the unnecessary stuff, and it's just a very clean foundation, and it uses sort of, you know, good, consistent typography, and there's good character and paragraph styles, and it would just be easier for somebody to work with as a foundation if they're not building a textbook.
How do you feel about the things that you studied at Brown in relation to the creation of this book that you just made?
Well, I think that, you know, it ties in terms of, you know, the switch to digital formats and to digital books. I think that this is a tool that hopefully will help authors, you know, move their work over there to digital formats and feel empowered to do so. I mean, I think, like, there's a few things going on with digital, right? There's, like, digital books from the perspective of readers, which is kind of what we were talking about a minute ago in terms of the market. You know, it's like, oh, you won't have mass market paperbacks, so use Kindle instead. There's also digital books from the perspective of authors. And for authors, you know, it used to be, you've always been able to self-publish a book. I mean, Mark Twain famously almost bankrupted himself self-publishing a book like 100 and however many years ago. So you could always do that. But up until the advent of, you know, digital reading platforms, that meant that you had to print all your books right away. So you had to pay to print your own books immediately. And that's like a huge financial risk that you're taking. And then, you know, getting hard copy books into the hands of readers is hard. Like, how do you do that? So with digital formats, you know, you've cut out two of those impediments. First of all, you don't have to pay up front to make a book. You just have to learn how to design a book yourself, like with this. Or you could hire a designer. You know, I mean, you could go down both roads. But I think with this guide, most people that are somewhat comfortable with a computer would be able to make their own book pretty easily.
I do want to remind listeners, this is Writers' Voices. I am Cheryl Fusco Johnson. You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM. We're community radio. We're solar-powered. And we have a very interesting guest today. It's Eric Johnson. I admit he is my son. I find him fascinating. But I think that he does have a lot to say about publishing. And he has just published How to Make a Book with iBooks Author. And right now we're talking about the advantages and disadvantages of e-publishing.
Right. So, you know, I mean, there's still definitely plenty of reasons to go through a traditional publisher and to go that route with books that you hope to publish. But there's, you know, certainly much, there's like a whole world of self-publishing possibility out there. And learning to use tools like iBooks Author is a key part of that. So, you know, I think that's the key. I mean, basically, like, I was interested in how to learn how to use the tools myself for other projects that I actually haven't even done yet. But I sort of went down this road where I started learning about how to do self-publishing and got fascinated with the tools and the process and ended up creating a guide about how to do it for other people rather than, you know, using the information myself right away. But so I think that it's just fascinating, and like the tools available are really powerful now, you know, especially with the internet as a platform. Like if you're a blogger or you're an author with a following on Twitter, you know, you already have like a base that you can market to. And there's, of course, you know, many more advanced strategies for marketing as well. And there's like learning to use Google Ads and building a mailing list and things like that. But if you have some kind of a following that you can market to and you're willing to learn to use some of these tools, there's really no big reason to go with a traditional publisher. And so I think that that's like a really, you know, it's a democratizing moment in the publishing industry. And it's like, it's a crisis moment, of course, too. You know, it's like publishers are terrified. It's like a big deal. We're starting to see books go down the same road that movies have been going down for the last couple years and that music did 10 years ago. So it's like a crisis moment. But when there's a crisis, there's an opportunity. And I think the big opportunity is for individual authors who have some kind of niche fame or niche, you know, following, like, you know, maybe if you're like a gigantic star, maybe it would still benefit you to get the global reach of like a big publishing house. But if you have, you know, a couple thousand Twitter followers, or, you know, 10,000 people on your mailing list, or 1,000 people a day come to your blog, that is the kind of niche popularity and niche fame that is totally sufficient to market your own book to. So if you're an author and you're in that kind of position, you know, it's a golden opportunity to kind of be in control of your own, of your, the whole process on your own.
Interesting. So one of the things that you did to master this tool of iBooks Author involved elements of style. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, iBooks Author came out, and there wasn't much of an announcement beforehand. It just, all of a sudden, it was just out in the world. And I immediately I thought, oh man, this is amazing. Like, I want to write a tutorial or create a video course or something about it right away. And I didn't have anything that I had that was sort of like unpublished and finished and conveniently perfectly ready to transfer to that, like right then and there. So I thought, oh, I need something to convert to this format that's in the public domain, of course, and that I could put up in this format as quickly as possible. And I thought about, I don't know what made me think about it, but I thought about the elements of style. And so I did exactly that with the original elements of style, the one that only Strunk alone wrote. See, Strunk was E.B. White's professor. So the version that most of us think of, where it's credited to Strunk and White, was really rewritten by White after Strunk's death.
But, let's also, for listeners who might not be familiar with elements of style, could you just explain
what
it is?
Yeah, it's like a writing style guide. So there is this guy whose name was William Strunk, and he was a professor at Cornell, and he wrote a short style guide for his students. He was an English professor, to teach them how to deal with kind of typical grammatical issues and typical stylistic issues that you encounter when you're writing in English. And E.B. White was one of his students, and I think that he like wrote a remembrance about Strunk in the New Yorker or something, and then he was approached by a publisher asking him if he would like to rewrite it and adapt it to a more modern audience. And so he did that in the 50s. Strunk wrote the original in 1918. And for like over a generation, that was like the go-to style guide for writing. It's short, it's concise, it's really opinionated. It's in some places arguably pretty wrong, but like, you know, be that as it may, it's definitely influenced like 50 years of writers in America. So I took the original, the 1918 original that was written only by Strunk, and it's actually a good bit shorter than the rewritten edition. And that, because it's written before 1923, is in the public domain now. It's out of copyright. So anybody's free to do anything to it. And I didn't change it at all. I just kept it exactly perfectly the same. All I did was adapt it to the digital platform. So I, you know, redesigned the pages, the fonts, the typography, the indentations, kind of made it so that it looked natural on the iPad rather than something that's obviously designed for print. And then the only thing I added to it was an index. So I indexed it, and it's actually like a hypertext index. So there's links that link from the index directly to that part of the text.
If people wanted to obtain a copy of that, where would they go?
Well, it's published for free on the iBookstore. So you could go and search in iTunes for The Elements of Style. And it would come up as the author being William Strunk and the editor being Eric Johnson.
Cool.
Yeah, thanks.
So that's any listeners who are interested in the original version of Elements of Style, that's where you can get it for free. Mm-hmm. And it is also an indexed version. So if there was a particular right. issue you wanted to look up, you could just link to it on your... So they would read
exactly.
it on an iPad.
You can only read it on an iPad. That's kind of the big limitation with the iBooks platform versus the Kindle. Like the Kindle, you know, you can read it on... Well, there's multiple Kindles. There's the first generation, second generation. I don't know what generation they're on now. There's multiple Kindles, the actual device. Then there's Kindle apps for Android phones, for Android tablets, for iPhones, and for iPad. And there's a Kindle app for PCs and Macs. So basically, you can read a Kindle book anywhere. iPad books, or iBooks rather, you can only read them on the iPad. That's the only way.
But a person can create a book using free software and put it in the iBooks bookstore.
That's correct.
Also for free.
Well, you can publish your book See, there's certain limitations. I mean, this is getting a little technical, but there's certain limitations that the iBooks author license, you know, imposes upon you if you choose to use it to write a book. So basically, you know, the main gist of it is if you're giving your book away for free, like if it's some kind of a promotional thing or you're just doing it for the love and you're just making it for free, you can give it away however you want. You can email it to people, you can offer it on your own website for free, and you can publish it in the iBookstore pending their review, you know, and this is Apple, so they're like pretty like family oriented, you know, so they're not anything like Amazon. Amazon is more like a real bookstore, like anything goes. Apple, they're more Disney-ified, so you have to be careful what you write, but like assuming it passes their, you know, passes muster and there's no nudity or anything like that, you can publish your book for free there. However, if you want to publish a book for a fee, if you want to charge for it, you can only publish it with Apple. You can't sell it on your own site or anywhere else. So you can only submit it to the iBookstore. And if they turn you down because it's like too racy or something, then you have no other place to sell it. You just have to edit it until it passes, basically. So that's just like something to keep in mind with iBooks authors. If you're doing a free project, anything goes. If you're doing a, you know, you want to charge for your project, then remember it's only available through the iBookstore.
Do you have any other comments about publishing or like the creation of your own book?
Well, I mean,
or electronic publishing in general?
It's definitely, I mean, just to come back to it, it's like a definite moment of opportunity, but it's constantly in flux, you know? Like, this interview we're doing is presumably going to be taped, and if you're listening to it in, like, 2014 or 2015, probably none of what we're saying will apply. Like, there's going to be whole new platforms out there, and there's going to be completely new tools, and, I mean, you know, it's like a struggle between Apple and Kindle for the share of the ebook market, and then there's the Nook that's also trying to get in there. So it's really hard to say what's going on. So I guess, you know, the hard part about being a self-publishing author right now is that you need to stay on top of it. You need to keep abreast of the industry. You need to keep abreast of like new techniques about how to market your work. And you need to stay on top of all these different tools and tool chains. And so, you know, maybe the big reason to stick with traditional publishing these days is just if you just don't want any part of that, like you just don't want to deal with that and you don't want, and it's too much to handle, then like go the traditional route. But if you're willing to stay on top of it the same way, say, a computer programmer has to stay on top of his or her, you know, kind of industry, or a designer has to stay on top of his or her industry, then it's definitely a big opportunity right now.
Well, what kinds of things can people do to stay on top of all this information?
Well, I mean, you know, you just got to, like, read the blogs. Like, you know, there's, like, a lot of blogs that discuss these exact topics.
Are there certain ones you would recommend?
Oh, even that is always in flux. I mean, I'm big on Hacker News, which is actually a forum. But digital publishing and digital media is, like, a topic that comes up there constantly. I don't know. I mean, there's a guy, he hasn't been blogging as actively lately since he joined a company, but his name is Craig Maud. It's like CraigMod.com. And he blogs about digital publishing and he's started his own press. And, you know, he's one of these guys that's exactly what I'm saying. He's got that kind of niche fame where he speaks to a very specific audience very well and markets his work to them, kind of. But he's been doing other stuff, so I don't think he's posted much in the last few months, but when he does, it's always something that, you know, just really is absolutely a fascinating take on digital publishing and the future of publishing and storytelling. So he's somebody to look for and definitely read his stuff. Neil Gaiman and Bruce Sterling, they're both more famous established authors, but they both, speak to these issues, I think, quite a bit.
It's interesting when you have these print authors who make a transition, like Robert Coover. Although he was very experimental with fiction, I wouldn't have necessarily thought he would embrace technology the way he did.
Yeah, I think it's sometimes surprising like who embraces new mediums and who doesn't.
Well, it's been a delight to talk with you today on all these different issues, Eric. So thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks again for having me.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.